people come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be ready to do.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see? You start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, by country tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
Want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. The first Sunday of September, I think, isn't it? It is. And you know, there's another harvest going on. You hear a lot about harvest and crush right now, especially because it's been coming so fast and furious, thanks in part to global warming. But there is another harvest going on as well. And no, it's not olives, which are increasingly called the second harvest here in the North Bay. But this is the hops harvest. And we have with us Brian Hunt returning. Brian Hunt, of course, of Moonlight Brewing. Fabulous brews, and also involved in the hops harvest. Welcome to Mouthful.
Great, thank you. Thanks
Welcome
for
back.
Me.
So you brought these beautiful hops. Let's just jump right in.
I did.
And there, I think the hop, what do you call that? Do you call that the flower?
Some people call them the flower, but they're not really the flower. Okay. I'm not really quite sure what
they're
they ought to be.
Whatever they are, I've always thought they're very beautiful. They remind me a little bit of one of my favorite ornamental plants, which is actually a type of oregano, and they're sometimes called a shrimp. A shrimp flower, a shrimp plant. They just resemble that a little bit. I think they're really pretty. How's the aroma? Mmm. Wow.
Now, that's one variety, and I have a second one here. They're often called cones,
but
also brewers
smells
talk about these
so
as
good.
Whole flowers, but they're not flowers. It's just one of those confusing sort of situations. The flower comes before this, and this normally would have the seeds in them. These are seedless because the males aren't grown, so they're never pollinized. And there's another variety. Those are called Chinooks, and the one on your right hand are Cascades.
This has a little hint almost of cucumber or something very cool.
Cucumber, interesting.
Something very cool. And this is very warm and evocative of other things that I've smelled from time to time.
Yes, they're very related.
That are grow and harvested.
Yeah, I guess that's another harvest this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence laughs.
sometimes this smell is also called gamey.
Gamey. This is the first one?
Yeah. No, yes, that one. Cat pee is one of the technical terms that brewers use actually to describe the Cascade and some of the other similar varieties. But a chef here in Santa Rosa, you've referred me to the word gamey as much more appropriate.
Well, the cat reference is also something that's used has been used to describe a certain Spanish olive.
Interesting.
Much to the dismay of the Spanish Olive Oil Council. There's a guy who still, I don't think, can go to Spain because he said that. I wouldn't say that.
These ones
actually,
I don't get
I'm
so
sorry,
much.
It just smells like marijuana flowers.
Okay.
It really does.
Uh-huh.
And the other one, it is something very cool along the lines of, like a combination of cucumber and menthol.
The variety of flavors is fascinating in hops. And in part, I like it because they're flavors and aromas that we don't affiliate with anything else. It's like if you have a different apple someone gives you, or a different grape, or even a wine that's made, oh, I can taste the berries and the cassis and then all different stuff. They're usually words we expect to find, but hops, people don't know what to expect mm-hmm. out of a hop. And there's fruity flavors, there's piney flavors, there's citrusy notes, as obviously a cat, there's pot notes, cedar notes. There's quite mm-hmm. a few different things. It's an amazing combination of flavors. I'd probably say unlike anything else I know, but I'm sure other people would disagree.
And where were these grown?
These are grown at the brewery.
Oh, at the brewery. So you're growing how much, how many?
I've got about a quarter acre.
Quarter acre?
Uh-huh.
And that provides hops for how much?
Pretty much a couple really special brews.
Uh-huh.
And I make them just for the hop season, kind of like a Beaujolais Nouveau.
Okay.
Whereas normally hops are dried, like these other samples I had. Now, these are two different varieties I have. Let's see.
Very sweet.
No, those are Pearlies. It's a German variety, but they're grown here domestically. These are grown out of Yakima. And this is one called Newport. Actually, it's made for the Rogue Brewery up in Newport, Oregon, is I think where the name came from.
Such variation.
Yeah. And these ones are even relatively common compared to a lot of the ones out there. It's actually fascinating. The Chinook, these ones. Normally, I think of them as having quite a pineapple smell and pineapple taste. And this year, because of the weather, everything was different.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get the pineapple so much. It's very fascinating how the flavors are very different this year.
Yeah, I smell it again, and I still say cucumber.
Okay. Well, I can't disagree with you.
Now, the hops industry, you're reading this really interesting book. I just have to grab it from in here. Tinged with Gold, Hop Culture in the United States. And you're telling me about, the third planting of hops in California?
Yeah, hops, when they first came to the United States, actually it wasn't the United States then, they came with the colonists. Colonists, of course, did like to make ale. And so they brought hops to Massachusetts and the colonies, eventually moved up to New York State and up to Maine even, and some down towards Virginia, but not as much. The higher latitudes were better. And then it moved into upstate New York and Wisconsin, and then pretty much jumped right out here. And even before the Northwest, which is the biggest hop-growing area today, the hops came to California. And I found this quote here I loved. It says, another early pioneer in the importation of hop roots was Amasa Bushnell, formerly a hop grower near Syracuse, New York. He brought the roots with him. In 1856, he planted them on a ranch in San Mateo County on the site of the present city of Burlingame. So that was the first hop planting in San Mateo County, which I wouldn't expect. And 2 years later, he teamed with the Syracuse native Samuel Downs and set out more hops in Vine Hill on the east side of Green Valley in Sonoma County. Now, a lot of people don't realize that Vine Hill was a town, but there is actually... That's right.
Yeah.
There's a B&B there, I know. And just like Trenton, there's a lot of Trenton roads because that was the road from Guerneville to the town of Trenton, which is pretty much where the Druids Hall is there on Laguna Road.
Mm-hmm.
So all these little towns used to exist back before cars made them, 30 seconds apart. So anyway, 1856 is when hops were first planted in this county. It does go on to say the Vine Hill field yielded a harvest of 200 pounds. In 1860, the Visiting Committee of the State Agriculture Society reported that the 15-acre hop field of Bushnell and his new partner was the largest in the state. That's 15 acres was the largest in the state in 1860. And subsequently, they awarded a silver vase at the state fair for the best acre of hops. So that's the history of hops. And then after that, they went into Hopyard Road area, which is down in Pleasanton. There was a huge hop acreage there for a long time. And Sacramento. I grew up in Sacramento, and I remember hop fields out there.
A lot in Sacramento, and they figure in some of the literature of California. It always makes me think of Joan Didion's first novel, Run River, which I probably mentioned the last time you were on, because you can't mention hops and the hops harvest and drying without me thinking of that book.
Yeah, and the town of Hopland was kind of interestingly known, I guess, because the town was named Hopland. They decided to plant hops there. Could have been the other way around, but apparently there were a lot of hops. Of course, this whole Sonoma County and Mendocino County area were huge.
And we had hops here until, the mid or early 1950s?
Yes, at least in the 50s, yeah.
And there was, what happened? Was it a virus?
It was a lot of different things. It's like any agricultural situation. One of the big things, ironically, was the Dauenhauer family of Santa Rosa developed a machine to automatically pick them. And picking is rather labor-intensive. And all of a sudden then, if you had large enough acreage that you could afford the equipment, then your picking cost just plummeted to nothing. And that would only work then if you had a large enough farm. Now, mm-hmm. most of the farms around here were small family farms. So maybe they were 20 acres. I'm just making a guess. I wasn't around much in the 50s. And so the folks here really couldn't afford to have the picking equipment. And so when the plants were then put in like Yakima Valley, and they put in 200, 300, 500 acres, all of a sudden the efficiencies just made the cost of growing hops here just impossible. Labor was a huge problem. After the war, you couldn't get much farm labor. I heard an old local farmer who passed away. I was a hop rancher. And he talked about after World War II, when it was so hard to get labor, he'd go to the drunk tank and basically pay everybody to get out of the drunk tank and have them come pick hops. The problem is, if they got paid, he'd have to go buy their way out of the drunk tank the next morning to continue the hop harvest. So that's how difficult it was to get hops. Traditionally, you know, schools would close like prunes, same way. Mm-hmm. Up in Healdsburg, I heard stories of the schools would close. Basically, everything would shut down. And that's the way it was really in a lot of the world, where the whole town would just stop and pick hops because mm-hmm. there's so much labor intensive. I mean, you see them here. They're about the size of the tip of your thumb from mm-hmm. the last joint on, small thumbs and big thumbs. And you have to pick them one at a time.
One at a time. And how high do they grow?
Well, they grow ideally 20 feet, but you cut the whole vine down.
Oh, you do?
Yes. And okay. So you're actually
sit and pick them off.
Yeah.
Clip them off.
Yeah, clip with your fingers.
Uh-huh.
And so you can imagine how long that would take. And obviously, they're very light.
Mm-hmm.
Even compared to a grape, a grape's probably 10 times as heavy as one of these. So.
At least, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm holding a handful, and you know, if I wasn't for the texture, I wouldn't feel anything in my hand. There's like no weight.
So, yeah, so you can pick all day, and you go, I have 3 pounds. And it's very disconcerting. So you can imagine the labor involved in doing this is quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there other people that you know of growing hops again in Sonoma County?
There's a few.
I know a couple of casual, I mean, very casual. They think they're pretty.
Oh, they're gorgeous.
Yeah, but anyone who's actually using them.
There is a small hop yard up in Healdsburg, which was first affiliated with when Corbell had the winery up there by Lake Sonoma. Mm-hmm. It was affiliated with that. And I do believe those were used this year. I think Russian River used those. There's a large group up in Lake County who is growing hops and selling them as fresh hops like this.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have 10 or 20 acres, and I can't imagine how their fingers are feeling this time of year.
Yeah.
Normally hops are dried. You pick them and then you dry them.
Dry them in a kiln?
Yes. You've heard of course, hop kiln wine. You've seen the ones like on River Road and there are quite a few of them around here.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I use them is I don't dry them. I keep them fresh. And I consider it like basil. Fresh basil is nothing like it.
Uh-huh.
But dry basil is also used. So if you want to make pesto, you certainly don't start with dry basil.
We're going to take a musical break here on Mouthful, and we'll be right back with more talk with Brian Hunt of Moonlight Brewing.
Mr. Moonlight, come again, please.
Yeah, it's Mouthful. It is KRCB. It's Michelle Jordan. I'm here with Brian Hunt. And, of course, I could spend several hours talking to you only about hops and forget to even tell people what you make. You make some of the best, if we call them handcrafted.
Sure.
Boutique. I don't know what the right word is.
But artisan.
Artisan. Okay. You make fabulous, fabulous brews. Ales. IPA I just wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
Wine of the week. But it's not wine. You just make beautiful, balanced, elegant, really perfectly balanced beers that feel really good in your mouth.
Well, thank you.
So do you want to say what you currently are making?
Oh, heavens. Well, my normal beer is right now the Reality Czech style Pilsner. This month is my most popular beer. Of course, it's been a little warm.
I would love that, and I've never had it.
Oh,
but I love a nice cold Pilsner when it's real. I mean, I love it as much as I can love anything when it's a million degrees.
Well, I thought Pilsners were just lame light beers. Even the major American brewers, which they aren't American anymore, but they claim their beers are Pilsners. And Miller Lite, on the label, it says a fine Pilsner-style beer. That's kind of the impression I got of Pilsner was. And then I went to the Czech Republic and went, oh, my God, you can have flavor, and they can be just... your eyes roll back, and that's... You can get that from a light beer.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to use the word light. And yes, absolutely delicate. So I determined when I came back I had to make those because I couldn't spend the rest of my life in Prague.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'd try, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I made... I learned what I needed to learn, and then I made one that I believe the Czech style is... Uh-huh. I tell people it's very authentic to the west coast of the Czech Republic.
And what is the name of it again?
Reality Czech Style.
Reality Czech Style, that's right.
Yeah. It's very fun to have a...
You have great names.
Well, thanks.
You have great names. Bombay by Boat, uh-huh. IPA.
Uh-huh.
Death and Taxes Black Beer.
Uh-huh. The Lunatic Lager is the other light lager I make.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then Twist of Fate Bitter Ale.
That I have not had.
Oh, Michelle, this is sad.
Yes, we'll correct that.
At all different ones from time to time. Normally each year I make homegrown from the fresh hops.
Mm-hmm.
I one place in the Toronado in San Francisco. It's called Green Bud, but they're the only place. Otherwise, it's called homegrown. And last year I made something new, which is what I'm going to make this year again. I've got a couple different things in mind, and the first batch will be one called Subliminal. And there's no hops in the kettle, which is the normal place you add hops. And I just put a little bit in the mash tun with the grain, which is kind of a wrong place to put it, but I don't often follow rules, apparently. And then the balance of the fresh hops I'm putting in the aging tanks.
Oh, really? So, and so what sort of results do you get?
Ethereal.
Well, okay, I was going to say, I bet you get higher notes than the...
Yes.
I think of hops, the bitterness of hops, as sort of the baseline, the bottom, and all the other flavors sort of dance on top of that.
Yeah, but you don't have to have a bitterness from the hops. Mm-hmm. The bitterness comes
only
bitterness
if you boil
them.
I mean, bitterness in a good way.
Yes, yes. But
yeah,
you, but you get the bitterness you boil for at least about at least 45 minutes to an hour. And so if you add hops very early, all the delicate aromas boil away, aromatics boil away, like true of spices or delicate herbs. And so the bittering aspects have to, chemically called isomerize, have to be extracted and then change themselves to a way that they'll stay in the beer. And that takes about 45 minutes minimum, like I said.
Mm.
So then if you want the bitterness, you add the hops early. And if you want different other components, you add them later. The very most ethereal components, you add them right near the end of the boil. So they boil, say, 5 minutes or even less.
Mm-hmm.
There's another fraction that I like. You boil about 25 minutes. Now, you lose the most delicate things, but you get an oil component that I actually think is the more psychoactive aspect of it. It's very calming, very smooth. I call it kind of oily. And that's a fun comment. Most people don't talk about that. They talk about bitter or aromatic. Uh-huh. There's a third.
Talk a little bit about that psychoactive element, because I remember a long time ago, I was in a psychology class at Sonoma State. I think it might have been about dreams. And I vaguely remember being told to drink hops tea because of the effect that it has on your dreams.
I couldn't tell you so much what the effects are in your dreams, but certainly it's relaxing, so it helps you have dreams. And hops are related to pot, very much so. They're in the same family.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a few other things, stinging nettles in the same family.
Oh, and stinging nettles are so delicious and so good for you.
Yeah, I don't know if they're psychoactive at all. But
only if you grab them before they've been cooked. You know, they'll make you very active.
Yeah, there's one or two other plants in the same family. So there's some similarities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that it's the same, not at all. But they have a nice relaxing effect and I guess you could say a stress-reducing effect. They also have a lot of phytoestrogens, plant estrogens, which do help compensate for women's estrogen, especially in menopause time.
Uh-huh.
And so they'll help you dream if you're in that situation as well. Exactly what kind of dreams they give you, I couldn't tell you.
Maybe it was that it helped facilitate dreams. There were several. There was Damiana hops. There were several different things that you were supposed to drink and see how it influenced your dreams.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, if somebody wants to do things at home with hops, uh-huh. other than drink the result of, you know, in a brew, how do they get them?
It's very difficult to find fresh hops like these.
Yeah.
I really don't know any place for a person to buy them. You can grow them, certainly, very easily. Mm-hmm. They're fun to grow.
And you plant in the spring.
Yes, you plant a rhizome, and they'll come back every year. Now, I keep mistakenly call them vines. Hops are actually a bine with a B.
A bine?
A bine, hop bine. A vine is something like a grapevine or a blackberry, where it has a nice green, flexible plant the first year, but that same plant, same part of the plant, the same branch, becomes woody the following year. And then stays as a permanent part of the plant. Whereas a vine like these, they die back to the ground. There's a rhizome under the ground, which then comes back every year. And everything above ground starts from scratch each year.
Each year.
And that's what makes a vine different than a vine.
Now, one thing I've been told, and I'm not sure, I lost my rhizomes, but I've been told that gophers don't eat them.
That's true.
Okay, so I want to grow some at my house because I have lots of gophers.
Now, I have found gophers sometimes like to go for the bugs and other things that are where the irrigation is that the hops like. And so you may find that the hops aren't eaten, but there's tunnels under your hops.
And that'll kill off the root system.
Oh, that just makes it a little more frustrating, I think, for the plant. So, but if you have enough cats, that usually helps the gopher situation.
Yeah, you'd think. unless you have really spoiled cats. So where are you in harvest right now?
I just did the first harvest yesterday, and we took half the field down. Some of the ones I have further down the hill, they get a little less light than the ones near the top, and they seem to be about a week or 2 weeks behind.
Okay.
Some of the ones are already overripe and are dried and shattered, and I can't use them. Whereas on the same plant, some of them are still unripe. It's a very confusing thing for the plants this year. Uh-huh. We had the 100 degrees, and we had the freeze, and I don't really think they knew what to do.
Yeah.
So I'll do one more pick next weekend.
Next weekend,
and that'll be it, yeah. You know, you had asked about what else people can do with these at home. You can grow them, or you can buy them dry at a health food store.
Oh, you can, okay.
Yeah, or even the home brew shop is a great place to get them.
Oh, okay.
Beverage People on Piner Road.
Uh-huh.
And I like to make a tea out of them, actually. It's you mentioned the relaxing effect and the dream-inducing effects. You make a tea out of them, kind of as much as you can get. If you can get the pellets, they'll work fine, too. The hops are often pelletized, look like little rabbit food. Or you can get the dried ones that look like this. And just steep them in hot water. I seem to think 140 to 160 is about the best temperature to steep them in. If you're higher than that, you get a lot more tannins, and it's kind of unpleasant. It's like tea where the tea bag's been left in too long.
Right.
You get all those tannins.
So you want to boil the water and then cool it, let it cool.
I'm not sure to even bother boiling it.
Not even bother boiling it. Just take it up, not all the way.
Yeah, but 120, you're not really getting as much character out of it as you really ought to. Mm-hmm. 140, 160, I did quite a few teas last year, different temperatures and different parameters. And then, personally, I prefer to chill them down, like as an iced tea, if you would. I don't bother with ice; just drink them cold, and they're amazingly refreshing. And I think they would help you sleep. Let's say.
I'm going to try that tonight.
Great.
So, what will happen? You'll get these picked, and then, but you're going to use them fresh.
Yes.
And one of the batches, you're going to add. At the end.
Right.
And then how long before people get to enjoy it?
About 3 weeks.
Okay.
And I'll wait and see exactly how long it takes for the good flavors to extract from the hops. Sometimes let them go additional weeks, so it could be 4 weeks from now. And then this next batch I'm going to make next weekend, I honestly don't know what I'm doing yet with it. I've got a few ideas in my head, and we'll see what that one's like. And so that one's going to be at least 4 weeks off.
And then how do people get to enjoy them once they're done?
Well, let's see. You could certainly email me, and I try to let you know where it is. Flavor Bistro down in Santa Rosa and Courthouse Square has all my beers on tap. Well, six of mine.
Uh-huh.
They don't necessarily have all that way. They'll definitely get some. There's very little of it. It's going to be a much smaller crop this year. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how much there'll be to go around. I'm afraid it won't be very much.
Okay, just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
But if you listen to Mouthful, you've heard it here first. So maybe you can find it. And then your other brews, Flavor, Downtown Santa Rosa. Uh-huh. I know Pasta Bella and Mambo's Pizza. Mambo's Pizza, I was just talking to somebody from there today. They have three of your beers on tap.
Uh-huh.
What are some of the
other
places?
I'm not going to remember them all. My apologies.
You cannot remember them all. Just a sampling.
The old Two Crows Roadhouse, which is Cafe St. Rose.
Yes, St. Rose. I live near there.
Oh, excellent. Okay, they have it for that. I think that's most of Sebastopol. Guerneville, the Stumptown Brewery in Andornos. Forestville, a Mosaic Restaurant on the other Andornos. Try to figure out my delivery route to remember a little bit. The Black Rose Irish Pub in Santa Rosa has the IPA. It's one of the two places in Santa Rosa that has the IPA, and they also have Death and Taxes. Pizzeria Grillo over in Bennett Valley, Pizza Gourmet on Fulton and Guerneville Road.
Uh-huh.
Boy, I know I'm forgetting some. Going north, Mirepoix Restaurant has the Pilsner, Manzanita up in Healdsburg, and Divine Pizza, and I know I'm forgetting some. And then more down to Cotati and Petaluma. Reezy Beezy also has the IPA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they have the Pilsner and the IPA and the Death and Taxes. And quite a few places in Cotati. Pretty much in the main drag in Cotati you'll find it.
Uh-huh. Popular in Cotati, are we?
Oh, yeah. Sonoma State Pub, next time you find
Sonoma
yourself
State
there.
Pub?
Yeah.
Great. I just keep smelling these hops. It smells so good. And it's only available that way. You don't do any bottling, do you?
No.
And
next
you have no plans?
Next lifetime,
that?
For sure.
Uh-huh. Now, what if somebody's having a party?
Kegs are available.
They
of course,
are.
Not
okay.
of the fresh hop beers because there's just not
sure.
enough. But I do sell kegs. I pretty much go through Bottle Barn. It's the easiest place to do
okay.
kegs. Yeah, I don't sell them myself.
Uh-huh.
It's just more than I can handle.
But somebody at Bottle, you can go into Bottle Barn and say you want to get Moonlight Brewing.
Yeah, call them up and tell them what you want, and they'll let me know, and we'll make it happen.
Cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. I like your glasses, Brian.
Oh, thank you.
Moonlight Brewing Company, and then there are quotes on the back. And this one is intriguing. Good beer is as good beer does.
Yes, that's what I believe. Some people think good beer ought to be like good wine. It must have a good score from some appropriate rating person. And you must be able to taste hints of cassis and blackberries and tobacco and all these things. No. If you have to taste all those things in your beer, you're really working too hard. That's for wine drinkers.
I think the same thing. I think the same thing about wine.
Oh, thank you.
You know?
How refreshing.
I mean, maybe I shouldn't admit that as a so-called wine writer. You know, tasting all those things is the job of a wine writer.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, it's supposed to make you happy.
Yeah.
Life is hard. Enjoy what you drink.
Yeah, and I suspect there's a lot of winemakers out there that are thanking you, like, effusively at this very moment for freeing them from all the efforts of having to be analyzed and scrutinized for their wines. Wine should just be enjoyable. Beer should just be enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want another one, and then maybe another after that, and could even be one after that, that would be good beer or good wine if it's that case. So that should be the ultimate
choice. I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. So what are we tasting?
What do you taste in there? Now that we talked about hints of all these different things, this is a beer that does have a few hops. I visited this brewery in Scotland, and this is made with heather.
Oh, wow, heather ale.
So hops are obviously a very big ingredient in all the beers that we know, But it hasn't always been, especially with the gruit herbs and stuff that were traditional up, actually even to World War II, some breweries used them. But into about the time of Columbus, gruit was still more popular than hopped beer. That seems amazing that doesn't seem that long ago.
It doesn't.
Yeah, hops happened much more predominantly after that time.
What do you think of this, Lawrence?
Professionally.
Well, I'm doing the controls while you take. Oh.
So this is legal?
If you spit it out.
You know, I don't know that I would have recognized heather.
Yeah.
I'm not a big consumer of heather, so it's not really on my radar, but it's an interesting flavor.
But just like you were pointing out all the different flavors you can find in the hops, it's not just there's the hop flavor, and if you add other things other than hops, you don't get the hop flavor and it doesn't taste like beer. No, you can add other things that remind you of all the different aspects of hops, just like this is somewhat very different to me, but it still is reminiscent of what beer ought to be. And that's fascinating that there's so many other herbs and flavors that, like I said, remind you and taste as though hops ought to be. I have another sample of beer here that has no hops in it whatsoever, and I love asking other people about it. So what kind of hops are in there? I go, wow, I think you used some of these, and maybe there's some Cascades, and there's another one in there. I don't quite get that one. And then I say, well, there's no hops whatsoever in there. And they go, that's why. But it doesn't taste like it's an unhopped beer because the flavors are similar enough.
Interesting. This is really interesting. It's if I was blindfolded, I would know I was drinking beer. But yet it is very different.
Yeah.
It has an interesting depth of texture. It's really rich.
Yeah.
And it's got this warm thing. It's not warm. I mean, it's cold, but it's got this warmth to it that it's really nice. It's really nice. It's refreshing. It's going to make me happy.
There's a little ginger in there too, I think. I couldn't quite get him to admit it, but I think he kind of admitted in a backdoor sort of way.
So. I can see that.
You get that in the nose.
I get it kind of an aftertaste. Some parts.
I see it in the aftertaste.
It reminds me of ginger ale for some moments. So, just another fun experiment there.
It's really nice. It's really nice. Have you ever heard of anybody making risotto out of hops?
You're the only person that I've heard
mention.
I've
got to track down who told me about that. I think it was last year or the year before somebody told me. I'm really curious about
it. Well, you know what would be fascinating is to make the hop tea, like I was describing to you. I think we were off air. We were on air. You make a tea and then use that liquid
to make the risotto.
Yeah.
And then can...
Oh, man, that sounds really good. I'm hungry now.
We should try that.
Okay.
we should try
that. There's a kitchen here, right?
There is. But there's no rice. There's no Violoni Nano, and that was the rice that's the rice I think you should use for hops.
Okay.
Hops risotto. I'll work on it. I'll let you know.
Good.
Okay, what's the other one?
Let's
see.
Let me get some more glasses here and open up.
Does each glass have a different quote?
I only brought two with the quotes. These ones
Lawrence,
are
what's your
unfortunately
quote?
Unquoted.
This glass says, in some breweries, the brewer tells the accountant what to do. Other breweries do it backwards.
I worked for Schlitz in Milwaukee for a couple years, and Schlitz has just been in the news because it's been brought back to life. And there's quite a history to Schlitz, and it's a very sad one. Up until about the time I was born in the late 50s, Schlitz was the number one beer in the U.S. And then Anheuser-Busch or Budweiser slowly overtook it. And let's just say they listened to their accountants too much, and they started to make really disgusting beer, technically really embarrassing. And still people would buy it. And the CEO of the company, Robert Eline, was quoted in the Milwaukee paper one day as saying, it doesn't matter what I put in the can as long as there's Schlitz on the label, people will buy it. Well, they did up till they read that, and everything seemed to change. They did some cost-cutting things just to make the beer quickly. And so it didn't age long enough, it didn't mature, it just wasn't right. As well as using ingredients normally used, of course, barley is a major ingredient, and most American beers have about 20% rice or corn to give it a little thinner body, a little more drinkability, and they can basically sell you more of it. Some breweries will use corn syrup to just make a little shorter use. It's just like using corn, it's just a little more processed. Mm-hmm. About 20%. Now, Schlitz got to a place where they're using 50% corn syrup, so it was pretty, let's say, watered down at best. Well, now, the barley has the proteins which give the head. So when they took all the barley out and replaced it with corn syrup, there was not enough ingredients to make nice foamy head on the beer. So they had to add something to make it, you know, foam up, probably a seaweed extract or something. And that reacted with something else they used to keep it from making a haze in there. And it made like little snow globes in every bottle. And they did that for several weeks before they finally got, actually it was probably more than weeks, probably a couple months. And they basically denied, oh, there's no problem, it tastes great. And then by the time it got, of course, to the customer shelves and people's refrigerators, it was just exactly like snow globes, little flakes of things. And that seemed to, for some reason, dampen the customer's excitement about the beer. And it pretty much just
that
went.
That was the end of that?
That was, yeah. And they were losing about 50% sales, 15% sales every year in closing a brewery. They used to have, I think, 15 or 13 breweries, and they just would close one by one each year. It was very sad. And when I joined them, and they had just sold one in New York to Anheuser-Busch, and I went into Milwaukee, and a year and a half later, they closed the Milwaukee plant. And
is that how you ended up here?
I'm from back out here, okay. But I went back there as my first job out of brewing school. And it was fascinating. Oh, amazing history right there. And just even lessons such as that, that don't pay too much, don't listen to your accountants if they're telling you what to do. You tell the accountants what to do. Say, all right, yes, we're going to make money, but we're going to make good beer first. And then we're going to make it profitably. Instead of we're just going to make as much money as we can, and who cares what we put inside it. That's just the wrong way to pretty much make anything that people should care about. And beer is something people care about passionately.
It is.
You just don't mess with that. You could probably mess with wine more than you could mess with beer. Bread, of course, caused revolution in France, the traditional ones, when the price got too high. Bread is something Parisians take pretty seriously. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know, you could pretty much have genetic engineered tomatoes that are, you know, bounce like Super Bowls or something, and I think people wouldn't really care. They're
actually
just tomatoes.
You know, actually, those tomatoes, those genetically engineered tomatoes, crashed and burned. They couldn't sell them.
Good. All right.
I went up to Davis to try one. This was Calgene, the Farmer McGregor tomato, I guess. And I went up and I tasted one, and they had tons of investors. There's the Calgene stock, and they were getting ready to release the tomato. Crashed, burned.
Excellent.
Yeah, people. It wasn't disgusting. On the tomato scale, so I thought, well, am I going to try this? It's like, you know, when did I not try something? It's my job. I'll try it. And it had good texture. It had good tomato flavor. I don't want to eat even a good tomato in January.
Right.
You know, it's a summer thing. But as far as a tomato went, it was good. But then it would sit on the shelf and not rot for 6 weeks. And I'm sorry, that's just weird. That's just too weird. And they couldn't get the public to accept it.
So. Well.
That's over.
So don't mess
happening.
Don't mess with tomatoes either. Then
don't mess with tomatoes. Don't mess with beer.
Yeah.
What's next?
Okay, so you have this other beer.
Right.
So
yes.
This is beer that I've made, and like I said, there's no hops whatsoever. That's the old one there. I consider this the second most indigenous beer to the Bay Area, besides steam beer. Steam beer, of course, the history of steam was when the German and Eastern European immigrants came to the U.S., especially the wave hit in the 1840s, 1860s, in that stretch. A lot of them, of course, came either directly or indirectly to California for the gold rush. Well, they got here, and they were thirsty for German-style beers, and, of course, some of them were brewers themselves, and gold panning didn't work for them so well, so they decided to make beer. And they wanted to make lager beers. That's what Germany and Eastern Europe drank, as opposed to the ales made in mostly Britain. Oddly enough, you need cold weather to make lagers, and San Francisco really wasn't very conducive to that. I guess maybe in summer. So they developed a way to make a beer. It's a lager beer, but at a higher temperature. They kind of optimized all the equipment and the ingredients just to make it work as best as possible, and that came out to be called steam beer. Yeah, and so it was specifically something out of necessity from the people that, oh, God, I've got to have lager beer. Don't give me that ale stuff. Those people who wanted to have it here, and of course you couldn't bring it on a ship in 1860 from Germany. It just wouldn't work. So on the West Coast, that's how you made as close you could as to a lager beer, is by making steam beer.
Interesting.
And that's why it's a unique thing for California.
For the Bay Area, yeah. And so this one is the second most indigenous.
Based on the ingredient. Any thoughts on what you think might be there instead of hops?
Nope. Okay. Wait. What is that? There's something really familiar.
Oh, yeah, it's very familiar.
And it's smoky around the edges, a little bit smoky.
Kind of, yeah.
A little bit smoky.
Something you could burn, maybe.
The bitterness comes at the end when you breathe back in a very pleasant way.
Now, it's funny because I actually don't think of it as bitter. And I studied a lot of how people perceive taste. Mm-hmm. And bitter is something that you perceive when you're on the back of your tongue or different parts. But also astringent is something that works as well to balance sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
And so this beer, where I don't think is so much bitter, has an astringency that fits that same need that your mouth has.
When I call that astringency, I guess when I think of astringency, for me there's usually another, and this could just be a quirk and I'm completely wrong, but I always think of astringency as having a little bit of a vaporizing element that goes up into your nose.
Well, there's something that goes up in your nose. This has redwood tips.
I was going to say that. I almost said redwood. I should have.
And you couldn't possibly think there'd be redwood in here.
I was going to say redwood, and partly I was going to say redwood, and this may have no connection because of the color.
The color is perfect.
But also you said, but also partly that little edge here. Uh-huh. It's like, and this is the way I work. I taste something, and I just free associate what pops into my head. And it was redwood that popped into my head.
I love for people to do that with a beer, to just free associate flavors.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to pick, like we were talking, you know, I taste the blackwood, taste the cassis. No, just does it work for you?
Yeah.
What do you get?
What pops into your head? I mean, I drink certain wines and I hear songs.
Yes.
And it's like, this is a very Brian Ferry song, you know? Or, you know, This is a saxophone. I don't usually listen to saxophone, but that's what I hear when I drink this. That sort of thing. Or literature, colors, textures, fabrics, times of day. You just free associate. It's not like you think it up. You just wait to see what comes into your head.
Yeah, I really believe beer ought to be poetic to you and ought to speak with you in that way and just kind of be more than just something to get you through the lawn mowing job.
Well, I'm so happy that I really did. I'm not making that up. I almost said redwood. We've got one more beer to taste, and we are running out of time.
Well, actually, we could even skip that one.
Time flies when you're around, Brian. Oh, Pliny the Elder. That's the hoppiest, right?
That's the hoppiest one. We could open
a
little
bit. Let's have a little bit, because I want to see what you call a really hoppy beer. Do you want to put it in here so we don't have to dirty another?
I have enough glasses. It's just not a problem.
Okay.
Now, this is actually not an IPA. Pliny would be called a double IPA. And double basically means it's got about 20% more alcohol, more strength, as well as about twice the hops.
Okay.
So this is, if I remember correctly, it's 8% alcohol. Yeah, if I had glasses, I could read for sure, but it's a number very close to that. And this is, especially in Sonoma County, people probably know this to be by the hoppiest beer they can find around here.
And it's really got a hoppy aroma.
Yes. And because it's in bottles now, I can bring it here to the station. So this has a lot of aromatic hops, a lot of just like what you can smell from that. Mm-hmm. And they use
really
in all
bitter.
Different ways.
Not much bitterness. A little bit at the end.
Right. See, now, again, like
but
I described,
more aromatic.
You don't have to get bitterness from the hops. Only if you boil them a long time. So there's a lot more hops used later in the boiling and also especially in dry hopping, in the aging tanks. And so you don't have all those things that are lost, and neither do they become bitter. So this is an entirely different angle than the whole bitterness.
It's really gorgeous. Will you come back? We're almost out of time.
Sure, love
to. Okay, you'll come back maybe when the fresh hops
Oh, the beer's ready?
Beer is ready. Come back and we'll talk about it on the air, and we'll do. And I'll tell you what, I'll make you a promise. I will find out about the hop risotto before then, and so we'll do that on the air.
And I'll make some hop teas.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, it's Brian Hunt of Moonlight Brewing Company. You can, if you want to get a keg, is that what I call it?
Sure.
For a party at home, you call Bottle Barn,
uh-huh.
and they'll arrange for that. Otherwise, you just find a pub near you, sit back, and let the beer make you feel good. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Now it is time for another book review. I'm writing about the book I read. I have to sing about the book I read. Well, I found the book I'll be cooking from for the next few years. It's called Platter of Figs and Other Recipes by David Tanis. If that name's not immediately familiar, don't feel bad. A lot of people have never heard of him. This guy's been flying below the radar for years, living in the shadow of the restaurant where he's cooked for more than a quarter century, Chez Panisse, and also in the shadow of its world-famous impresario, Alice Waters. It's a little-known fact outside the food world, but Alice Waters rarely, if ever, cooks at Chez Panisse. But boy, oh boy, does she know talent when she sees it. Chez Panisse has birthed many famous chefs: Jeremiah Towers, Paul Bertoli, Deborah Matterson, Mark Miller, Jonathan Waxman. Tanis has shared the stove with all of them, though not, alas, the limelight. A Platter of Figs, his first book, may change that, though judging from the low-key, self-effacing style of this book, I'm not sure Tanis will welcome the public acclaim. He's got a great deal at Chez Panisse. He and French chef Jean-Pierre Moulet now share the helm, working 6 months on and 6 months off. When he's not cooking in Berkeley, Tanis lives in a 17th-century apartment in Paris, where he hosts a private dining club, turning out meals in his cramped 6-by-10-foot galley kitchen. A Platter of Figs is, first of all, a beautiful book, large and substantial in the hand, with a sewn binding and matte rather than glossy paper. It's a book designed to hold up to years of hard and grateful use. The photography is honest and elegant, and like Chez Panisse itself, it's all about the ingredients. The title, A Platter of Figs, epitomizes Tanis's culinary aesthetic, simple and plain, almost to the point of Puritanism, yet hedonistic in its celebration of the sensual flavors of real food. It's an interesting balance to strike, one that goes to the heart of what happened when some members of the 60s counterculture, Waters and Tanis among them, took to translating their deepest-held values, authenticity, diversity, and an almost religious view of the earth, into food on a plate. Like most Chez Panisse cookbooks, A Platter of Figs is divided into seasons and offers 3- and 4-course menus, showcasing the best that each season has to offer. In spring, you'll find fava bean salad with mountain ham and mint, and roasted veal with morel mushrooms and saffron carrots. In fall, there's roasted pepper salad and duck breast with baked figs. The recipes are easy to follow, using basic ingredients that most cooks, especially California cooks, will have easy access to. These recipes are designed to let the essence of the food shine through, so the key to their success is starting out with the freshest, most flavorful ingredients possible. That said, the book's simplicity is deceptive. These aren't 30-minute recipes with just 3 ingredients, a strategy that Tanis suggests is all about getting out of the kitchen rather than reveling in its pleasures. This, rather, is a book for people who enjoy the camaraderie of the kitchen and love to cook. I, for one, plan to be cooking from this book for a good long time. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful. Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan.
Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.